Asked to plug a few books. The first one is by my friend Greg Kokel, whose picture you saw a few minutes ago. Greg is the man in charge of Stand to Reason, and he's got his own radio show. He does a very good job. This is one of the most easy-to-read, helpful, practical books you'll ever put your hands on. That is, if you want to know how to raise and answer the right sorts of questions, Greg's book on tactics is very good. I strongly recommend it. If you want to understand communism, you might want to pick up the book by Fred Schwartz that's been recently re-edited by Dr. Noble. If you don't know Fred Schwartz, he was a medical doctor from Australia who over time felt called to stand up as a voice against communism internationally. And he thought, well, what should I do to be against communism? He said, I'm going to leave Australia, come to California, and start my Christian anti-communism crusade there. And in so running those crusades in Southern California, he got a hold of Ronald Reagan and taught him a lot about anti-communism and let Reagan be his substitute speaker occasionally. So Fred is a guy to whom we all owe a big debt. And David has taken Fred's book and brought it up to date. Fred died a few years ago, I'm sorry to say, in his 90s. But not many people did more good for the world than Fred Schwartz, even though he's not as widely known as he needs and deserves to be. This book is a classic book. It's Doc Noble's Understanding the Times. It just takes you through all the various fields of academic study and it compares how different worldviews treat those. How do Marxists do it? How do feminists do it? How do New Agers do it? Everything you can think of, these 10 major topics are explained according to all the different competing worldviews. And along with those competing worldviews, Doc will show you how Christians think their way through these same things as well. This is a very useful book, but you can see it's a very big book, so you won't be able to finish it quickly if you buy it. Remember that it's a tortoise and hare affair. It's faster to go slow, so just take your time, and you'll be glad you did. Now, they've asked me to plug this book. I know the author, and despite the fact that he is who he is, the book might still be good. I'm just saying, in case you wanted to know, the lecture that you just heard a few moments ago is the last chapter in this book, so you can have it written for him if you like. It's called Pilgrim Theology. And Pilgrim Theology is as opposed to Fortress Theology. Some people have a theology they think encompasses all the truth, and if you disagree with them, you disagree with God, because they have all the answers. Well, I would rather you'd had a Pilgrim Theology, that you spend the rest of your life traveling toward the truth, not hunkering down prematurely, thinking you've already answered all the tough questions. So it's the difference between Pilgrim Theology and Fortress Theology. Now, I was supposed to say something else? Oh, Summit Semester, that's what it was. Summit Ministry started more than 50 years ago when David Noble began these two-week-long sessions in the summer in the Colorado Springs area where high school age and college age students could come and learn about a Christian worldview and how that Christian worldview applied to human activities all across the board. It's a really good introduction to how to think in a Christian fashion. It's very much worth attending if you either are a high school and college age person or you are the parents of one. I think the folks at Summit do a good job. And so I would say to you, consider it, please. Now, after having that two-week session, if the student comes home and thinks, I'd like more of that, what Summit also has is what they call Summit Semester. We do the same thing, but for 3 months. And what happens is You know what advocatus diaboli means? Devil's advocate. Okay, that's what they pay me to do. I go there and I try and help the students in a course on English literature, in a course on the history of theology, and in a course on Christianity and politics. I help them think through their views on those three things. But I do it from an adversarial stance. I try to do for them in a friendly setting what the world would do to them later in an unfriendly setting, so that they can learn how they can learn what their weaknesses are and fix them before they get out into the world and embarrass themselves. So it's sort of like boot camp for the brain. I remember my drill instructors in boot camp, I sometimes wondered if they thought I was on the other side, you know, because it was like merciless. And you wonder, what are they thinking? But after a while, you realize if they're easy on you, it's a false mercy, because then you're all that much more likely to die. Now, in the 80 people that were in my Marine Corps platoon in boot camp, not one of them died in Vietnam. They did a pretty good job, those drill instructors. And so, at Summit Semester, I'm the theological drill instructor. And my job is to put my thumb on them and make them squirm. So let's say there's a kid named Joey sitting there. And maybe Joey's an intelligent kid, and I'll ask Joey a question. And Joey will probably give me a sensible answer. But I want to know, is Joey lucky or is Joey good? And I won't know until I put my thumb on him, make him squirm, and find out where the answer comes from. Because the enemy isn't just the wrong answer, it's the right answer for the wrong reason or for no reason whatsoever. But I won't know until I get inside Joey's head and make him answer tough questions. Now, I tell the students, I've been doing this for 30 years. And in 30 years, only like 6 or 8 students have died from it. So the odds are they're going to get through. And I say, you know, and there's 30 of you, so the odds against you getting called on are 30-1. And it's fun to watch. So just enjoy yourself and go along with the program. But I'm serious when I say this. The Summit Semester program really has a big impact on the students. Why? Because they're away from cell phones and computers and televisions for 3 months. And they're in a community of students their own age who have the same goals. We're trying to figure out what God's all about and how he relates to every facet of human activity. And so when you get them away from all the distractions of modern life, in a group of other Christians who have the same goal in mind, remarkable things happen. They make friendships that last the rest of their lives. It's really good to do. I would say, if you as a student can go there, or if you as a parent can send a student there, it really is worthwhile. Now, let's say you've been to the 2-week summer session and to the three-month fall or summer session for the worldview stuff, we're still not done with you, because Summit also has an Oxford semester. You want to be an Oxford student? We can get you in and through. We're not going to just leave you hanging. They have a curriculum from pre-kindergarten all the way through Oxford if you want that. I'm just telling you, I think Summit does a good job, and I would like you to consider what they offer to see if that might work for someone in your family. Commercial's done. Now, our first hour was a little bit more formal. You know, I'm sort of reading a lecture, and we wait for the questions until the very end. Let's do it this hour a little bit more informally. What I mean by that is, as I'm talking, if you have a question, maybe something I've said raises a question in your mind, or maybe you think I'm wrong. It happens a lot. Raise your hand, and if I see, I'll call on you. We'll stop and answer your question at the moment so that it doesn't get forgotten later. So what I just want to do is I just want to talk with you about, I'll change that. I want to complain. I want to make two complaints, in fact. I'm going to complain about communism. I'm going to complain about the American professors with whom I work who don't complain about communism, and tell you why I think both those things are wrong. That's what I want to do. Now, I'm also going to start by doing what academics should do but normally don't. I'm going to start by defining my terms. By communism, we can define communism by two means. The first way to define communism is to define it by how it works or by its means of working. Communism by its means is when the state owns and controls the means of production. That is, they own the factories, they'll decide what the factory makes, they'll decide who works in the factories, how many units the factory produces, who should buy it, how much it sells for. They're in charge. The state owns the means of production. Now, you've probably heard that sometimes you can tell a thing by its fruit. Well, okay, if you want to define communism by its fruits, here are the fruits of communism: arrest, purge, prison, poverty, death. That's what it produces. How many times? More than 50 million. That's a lot. Heck, the communists are practically as bad as America's abortion doctors. That's pretty bad. There was a man named Martin Amis, an Englishman, who wrote a book on Joseph Stalin, the infamous communist dictator, who killed millions and millions of people. And as Martin Amis tells you at the beginning of his book, he says, I just want you to know that Joseph Stalin killed so many people that he killed 8 people, not for every word in my book, but for every letter. That's how bad it is. And if you can't learn to hate that, then I wonder what you could learn to hate. If you ask American intellectuals what communism is, they don't think it's all that bad for some reason. I don't know what that reason is, if there is a reason. But it doesn't matter to them. If they read Lenin, another communist dictator, they seem to overlook the part where Lenin says that American intellectuals, that is Western intellectuals, are useful idiots. Useful because they're idiots. They're idiots because they don't understand the real nature of the thing they're looking at and thinking about. And so what Lenin did frequently, realizing how pathetic intellectuals were, he made up several long lists of intellectuals who he felt were good for nothing but deportation, exile, or execution. And yet they still like what he does. What they don't like is someone like Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who I think was probably the greatest man of the 20th century, a Soviet intellectual. They did horrible things to Alexander Solzhenitsyn. He came to America to speak at Harvard, and Harvard didn't like him. Well, that's pretty high praise if you ask me. William Bennett once was a keynote speaker at a function I attended, and he's a Harvard grad. And I think we were at a little college outside of Detroit called William Tyndale College, and Bennett was speaking, and he said, I've been at Tyndale College now for two or three days, and I've noticed something. Tyndale College is not Harvard. People are going, oh my gosh, I can't believe he's... And then he said, thank God. So, what I'm saying is, we're talking about a system that was characterized for years by something called death by quota. Every group had to have their percentage of dead people. Because, as Stalin said frequently, death solves all problems. And if you're a person addicted to freedom, you're a problem. And if we can't break your addiction to it, you're going to have to die. And 50 million did. And in fact, some people say that Joseph Stalin's greatest accomplishment is what's called the necropolis, the city of death. A necropolis is a common grave for between 100,000 and 200,000 people all at once. So imagine your whole city and county being executed and then shoved with bulldozers into an open pit and buried. That's what we're talking about. Now, why would they do that? Because you can't make communism work because communism is a system that emphasizes equality, unless you take away people's freedom. This is where equality goes. It means that we're going to have to make you like everybody else. And if you will not conform, you'll have to be eliminated. The thing is that communism is, by its history and by its means, it's a conspiracy to violence. Because short of violence, it can't succeed. Now, even with violence, it can't succeed. It's that hopeless of a system. But people try it, and they try it over and over again, and they never learn the lesson. Human beings, you'll remember, are slow learners. I'm proof. It's gangsterism imposed by the government. And you can't plan on coexistence with communism. That's not going to work. They are not here to coexist with you. They are here to conquer you. Perhaps you remember Nikita Khrushchev saying, "We will bury you, and you will sell us the rope that we hang you with." Well, he wasn't kidding. That was the goal. It wasn't going to work. I mean, look, I agree with I agree with Reagan, who ever since he was back in the 1940s, when he was in the Screen Actors Guild and was president of that union, he made it his point to see if he could find a way to bring communism to its knees. And he said, "Here's my plan. It's a simple plan. We win, they lose." "Okay, I'm with you so far, Ronnie. How do you plan to do this?" He said, "I am quite convinced that the communists' cockamamie economic system cannot possibly produce the goods. We can crush them economically and therefore technologically." And so when he goes to Reykjavik to talk with Gorbachev, he says, "I'll tell you what, Mikhail, we're going to start this Star Wars initiative, this strategic defense initiative that will make all nuclear weapons obsolete. And if you like, we'll give you the technology too, so that no one's going to disarm, but we're going to, because we don't trust anybody to disarm, but we will make your weapons obsolete and give you the technology so that you can make ours obsolete, and then you have a world where the nuclear weapons aren't really going to be a threat." Now, Gorbachev should have known, but didn't, that Reagan was not negotiating as a fraud or a fake. He knew that the Russian economy couldn't produce that kind of technology. And Gorbachev knew his economy couldn't produce that kind of a technology. How do I know that? A friend of mine went to school with Gorbachev. They went and they studied economics together. And they both said to each other, this can't possibly be made to work. But the system's in place, what are you going to do? Well, my friend said, "I'm leaving." He became a refusenik and went to England and finally came to Hillsdale after that. He still had lots of friends among the Soviet generals and things once he got to America. And Alex used to call the generals and find out what they were thinking when Gorbachev and Reagan were in power. And when Reagan pulled off the first couple tests of SDI, the generals said to Gorbachev, "The game's over. We can't compete. It's done." And they were right. It didn't take long, by 1989, for the wall to come down, for the things behind the Iron Curtain to be free, and that whole system was gone. Because it has this colossal weakness. It can't produce the goods. You want the technology that brings strength and liberation, you're going to have a free market economy. And they weren't about to do that. Even though Gorbachev knew he couldn't win this thing. Well, I think because Gorbachev knew he couldn't win it, that's why he started things like Glasnost and... what was the other one? Perestroika, yes. He's trying to... Gorbachev isn't stupid. He knew that once that card had been played, all he could do was watch over the dissolution of his empire. And that's what happened. And he's just making that possible so the exit won't be so embarrassing. But we have multiple times historically, and we have multiple times philosophically and economically proven that communism cannot and does not work. But see, here's the problem with that. You must never believe that ideas die just because they've been refuted. Why? Because American intellectuals will find some way to revive them. There's almost no idea so stupid and preposterous that some PhD somewhere won't advocate it, write books on it, and get on the television and make millions of dollars selling this book. If you've read your logic book, then you'll know when they're talking nonsense. But yeah, ideas don't die because they've been refuted. My dissertation was on John Milton, and my doctoral dissertation mentor was a man at Princeton named Morris Kelly. And Morris said to me, "Now, Mike," Morris was not a Christian, and he said, "Are you a Christian?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, I'm going to tell you something frankly. I don't think then you'll be able to do this project because I've dealt with Christians for 30 years on this topic, and they're always cheating. They don't know what they're doing." I thought, wow, who's he been talking to? And he told me, and I read their books, and he was right. They didn't know what they were talking about. Not because they were, because they were Christians who couldn't think well, not because they were Christians. And so Morris said, there are some people, you must understand, some people that are proof-proof. Like you have a rain jacket, it's waterproof. The water hits it and rolls off. There are people that are proof-proof. The proof hits them and it just rolls off. Has no effect. They just keep going right on as if nothing happened. We call those people professor. So yes, go ahead and try to refute the ideas. You have this obligation to be a friend of the truth. And you have this obligation to put the truth out there in a clear and compelling, memorable fashion. And some people are teachable, and you'll get through to them. And some people aren't, and you won't. But when it comes to America's resistance to communism, it's as if we were addicted to halfway measures. Let's not try to defeat it. Let's live in peaceful coexistence if we can. And so we try to meet them halfway. But if you think that you can bring this bloody, murderous, awful mess to its knees with halfway measures, you're not paying attention. That's not what's going to happen. Halfway measures are the communist dream come true. You might notice that communists use halfway measures too. They're not stupid. They know their system won't work. So what do the Chinese communists do now? They bring in capitalist companies and let them have a halfway bid of freedom. And those halfway free Western companies are able to provide the technology and the products and the goods and services, even under the halfway measure, that gives the communists the money and success they need in order to keep their agenda going. If you think halfway measures work, they don't. They don't work for us. They do work for them. So it's sort of like saying, I think I'll try peaceful coexistence with cancer. Or I'll keep rattlesnakes around the living room as pets. Probably a bad idea. And so I'm just saying, don't be afraid to go the whole way, because that's what it's going to take on this issue. Communism doesn't die. Well, okay, communism does die, but it keeps resurrecting. And the American intellectuals are the ones that keep conjuring it back to life. Well, someone has to persuade them to stop. And since they're not teachable, you might have to go around them to do this job some other way. Communism has a limitless agenda. That is, they're looking for world domination. If they're out to get the whole world, they're not going to stop halfway. You actually have to stop them. When you face colossal evil, halfway measures aren't a suitable response. But halfway measures are our habit of mind when it comes to relating to this, to the communist threat. Think of it this way. Communism is theft. It steals property. It steals livelihoods. It steals lives. It steals nations. Stop the thief. Communism is atheism applied to politics. And in atheism applied to politics, there's no such thing as property rights. They don't care about who owns what. They're just going to take it because they want it and they can do it. So all I'm saying is that the communists don't really care about the truth or freedom. They're the enemies of truth and freedom. And you can't let that stand unopposed. You have to sound the alarm. You have to bring the Minutemen out to fight the battle. Because every place communism goes, famines follow. A famine of truth, famines of food. How many times do those five-year plans produce famine? Almost every time. Now, it wasn't because of droughts. It was because this system can't work. Famines of freedom, famines of life. All of a sudden, people die by the millions. Now, let's just have a little test. Raise your hand if you think, let's see here, how do I want to put this? Here's a quotation. From each, according to his ability, to each, according to his needs. I've asked people who said that. Lots of them say, Jesus! Well, Jesus wasn't actually a communist. I hope that isn't news to you. Now, let me see if I can make it more plain. What is it that communists don't understand? Well, the first thing they don't understand is they don't understand human nature. If you want to be an insightful politician and an insightful political thinker, you have to remember that the knowledge of human politics depends upon the knowledge of human nature. If you don't know what people are like, you can't do this very well. Well, here's what people are like. Despite this communist penchant for equality, everybody gets the same and we all live in these little indistinguishable cubicles as if human beings were just cogs in a machine. If you think that human beings are all the same, you don't get it. Human beings are, first of all, creatures of incentive. If you put incentives in front of people, guess what they do? They follow them. That's probably why our welfare system doesn't work very well. Because human beings are creatures of incentive, and our welfare system puts the most diabolical incentives in front of people. For example, in the welfare system, let's say you're a young woman eager to get out of your parents' home. You don't have many marketable skills. Here's an option. You want to get out of your parents' home out on your own? Have a child out of wedlock. If you have a child out of wedlock, we'll give you money for education, child care, food, medicine, housing. And if you want more money, have a second kid. But it can't be by the same guy. Because if it's by the same guy, then we're pretty sure there's a man hanging around who should be paying for all this. In other words, here's an old rule of economic thumb. If you get more of what you tax, I'm sorry, you get less of what you tax and more of what you subsidize. And we subsidize illegitimacy. Don't be surprised if you get more illegitimacy then. Because human beings are creatures of incentive. Now, communism just bypasses incentives altogether. Let's say you and your friend work side by side on a factory assembly line. It doesn't matter how hard you work, you won't be making more money. It doesn't matter how little he works, he won't be making less. Well, where are the incentives to hard work? Gone. Why do you think that they can't produce stuff over there? Because they don't understand that human beings are creatures of incentive. Ideas have consequences, bad ideas have bad ones, and their view of human nature is a bad idea. But if you're going to control things by government, every law you ever pass, every policy you put into place has its own peculiar set of incentives. You have to think about really carefully, what incentives am I putting in front of people because they're going to follow them? Let's say you're a Christian and you're concerned about homelessness. Well, you ought to be. And so you think, well, I should get on the city council and persuade the city council to pass rent control ceilings. That way, we'll make the apartments cheaper for people to rent. And if there's cheaper apartments, there's going to be less homelessness. Well, remember this, that good intentions are not enough. You have to think with your head and not with your heart. So, let's say we're going to put a rent control ceiling of $500 on apartments of a particular size in this city. Now, that policy has a good intention, but it's a stupid policy. Why? Because you've just put an incentive in front of a landlord. What's the incentive? I think I'm not going to be able to pay for all the upkeep on this thing. Because at $500, I can't afford it. And so what happens? The upkeep gets delayed, and the condition of the apartments gets worse. Here's another rule of economic thumb. The condition of an apartment follows its price. If you keep the price down, you keep the condition of the apartment down. And all of a sudden, now the poor people that you're trying to help are living in apartments where the walls are cracked, the sinks are leaking, the electricity doesn't work right. Is that what you meant to do? No, but because you're stupid, that's what you accomplished. Because you forget that human beings are creatures of incentive. You think like a communist. You think the government can fix all this stuff. Not possible. So they're creatures of incentive. Think of what incentive are you putting in front of people. So maybe you want to try this. Okay. We can't. Let's. The landlord's thinking, all right, I can't make a profit on this apartment at $500 a month. I can't pay for the upkeep at $500 a month. I'm just going to sell it off as a condo. They go to condo conversion. Okay, let's think about that. You know, we put that incentive in front of them. I'm going to sell it off as condos. That way, I can make a lot of money. And I don't have any more upkeep to do. And I don't have to pay. It's not my problem anymore. So, you know that when the supply of a thing goes up, the price goes down. You've just made the supply of condos go up in town, which means the price of the condos is going down. You just helped the people rich enough to buy condos in town. The number of apartments that's left, when the supply goes down, the price goes up. You just made apartments more expensive. Good move, right? Well, no. Always remember to assess the incentives. And here's where communism goes wrong. There's no incentive to work hard because you won't get ahead. And if you don't work hard, you don't fall behind. So, think of it this way. There's no prosperity without work. And there's no work without incentive. If you evacuate the incentive, the products and the work and the prosperity all run away. And that's why no communist country is ever going to be rich and never has been. Number two, not only are human beings creatures of incentive, they're not all the same. You cannot treat human beings as if they're all the same and get them to do good work. Maybe you've seen Soviet-era housing. You know, it's ugly and a blight beyond belief. It's just the same cubicle time after time, thousands of times. And you think, but people aren't like that. People don't want to live in these little pens because while the pens might all be the same, the humans who live there are not. And they will rebel against this kind of life. You won't get them to be happy, productive people in that setting. They're not all the same. You're going to have to find out, each person knows what he or she is like, what they want, what they need, and what they'll sacrifice and work for. Let them do it. You can't force them into this mold where every human being's alike and they'll always do the good thing. They will not. Human beings are lazy and they won't work unless there's incentive. And this gets rid of the incentive. Number three, human beings always work with imperfect knowledge. None of us knows all we need to know to live life well and wisely. We always work with imperfect knowledge. Now, no one knows you better than you do. But even you don't know you well enough to do all the right things for you. Well, what about those people who know you less well than you do? If you're going to let them make choices for you, they're going to make all kinds of mistakes and you won't like it. Because you know better what your desires are. You know what your resources are. You know what your values and commitments are. And they don't. If you let them control your life from a distance, they're going to make a bigger mess of it than you did. Now, imagine if you were a bureaucrat working in the budget office in Washington, and you were trying to help make policy decisions for 300 million people. You don't even know their names, let alone their resources, their intentions, their desires, their expenses. You couldn't possibly begin to make the same kind of decisions that they make for themselves. And the decisions that they make for themselves aren't going to be all that good. So you're going to make bad decisions for millions. That's a terrible idea because your knowledge of them is even more imperfect than theirs is. Central planners can't possibly know everything they need to know to make decisions for a whole country. The only person who could be an effective economic bureaucrat is God. And I haven't noticed him working prominently in Washington lately. And so the communists don't understand human nature. That's a big mistake. They also don't understand cause and effect very well. That is, when they explain how things happen and why things go wrong, they always look in the wrong spot for the explanation. They're always talking about, say, like class struggle. They like to lump people into groups, into classes, or genders, or races, or sexes, or whatever. They like this sort of class amalgamation way of explaining things, and this class is going to rise up and destroy that class. Well, but you know what? Human history isn't explained by class warfare. Classes don't do anything. Only individual humans do things. You have to think about human beings, not humanity. The individuals exist, the classes don't. Classes are a sociologist's fiction. They are mental categories that sociologists and communists take human individuals and stick them into. But the classes they're just intramental. They're not outside your head. Only real humans are outside your head. You need to think about them as real human individuals, not members of a group. But the communists are thinking about classes and class warfare. Or they'll think about the spirit of the age. Or an idea whose time has come. It's not about the spirit of the age. It's humans who make the difference. But the humans are what's left out of the equation in a communist worldview. They have a faulty view of justice. That's a big failing. As we said earlier, justice is getting what you deserve. Injustice is getting worse than you deserve. Mercy is getting better than you deserve. The communist thinks that justice equals equality. Equality is getting what everybody gets, regardless of what you deserve. Maybe by talent, effort, accomplishment, good looks, luck, genetics, you're better than your neighbor and produce better than your neighbor. Well, then you deserve more than your neighbor does. If you take those people who by various means have figured out how to tower above their neighbors, if you cut their legs off and make them all the same size, all you've done is got rid of excellence. What kind of a system decides to bring all heads down to the same level? But they're thinking, we have to be just. And justice is equality. No, it isn't. They also have a faulty view of wealth. Lots of people seem to me to have the same view of wealth that the communists have. They have the view of wealth that wealth resides in things, in stuff, like silver or gold. No. Wealth does not reside in matter. Wealth resides in mind. It's the mind that figures out ways of giving value to the matter. Who would have thought that sand was important and valuable? Well, it wasn't much valuable until somebody figured out how to make computer circuits out of it. And all of a sudden, some genius guys figured out how to capture wealth in sand. That's a trick. You try it. You try some way of turning sand into something valuable. And it'll stay valuable till some other smart guy comes along and figures out a way of turning something else into computer circuits that are even better than sand. Because it's the wealth in mind that matters. If you think that wealth resides in stuff, then you try to control the stuff and who has it. And what's going to happen is the geniuses outside your system are going to figure out ways of putting the wealth in other stuff, and then where will you be? If wealth is, see, stuff is manageable. Stuff is divisible and saleable and all that. But genius isn't, and creativity isn't. You can't control creativity the way you can control stuff. And so the communists are thinking, well, I can't control what people think. Oh, they try. But, you know, you just don't know where the next great breakthrough is coming from, do you? Almost always, the new breakthroughs don't come from the leading companies in the field. They come from those guys who are doing stuff by themselves out in their garage. That's where the genius is. And you can't control that stuff. All you can do as a government is back off and give it room. But you can't run it, because genius can't be controlled by government operation. But the idiots in government think it can be. They think that the state can own and control all this, and it can't. What I'm trying to say is that for some reason, America's intellectuals haven't noticed that system can't work. And they make fun of the people who point it out to them. You know, think of what happened to McCarthy. He's the bad guy, not the communists. We now know, don't we, McCarthy was right. But you want to call somebody really the name really bad, call him a McCarthyite. Oh, that will do it. As opposed to the people that... He was right that in the Roosevelt administration there were all kinds of communists running around. That's just the way it was. It's embarrassing, but it's true. And I don't know if they're still running around in Washington or not, but it wouldn't shock me, because the policies seem to have that family resemblance. The government controlled this. Like health care. Sure, we can do that. Let's control the doctors and the medicine and the costs and the hospital. Now, just think about the arrogance of this kind of thinking, that the government control not just the means of production, but the means of healing. So we think that the doctors and the drug companies charge too much. So we're going to hold the price down on this. Okay. What are the incentives? The incentives for the doctors are, you know, I spent all that money getting a bachelor's degree. Then I went to medical school and I did my residency and all this stuff. I took 10 years out of my life to get to this spot so I could make a good living for myself and my family. And now you guys are going to tell me that I can't charge enough money to pay myself back for all that work and all that and all that investment? That's what they're telling them. So guess what those smart guys do who were going to be doctors? They go into some other career path, and all of a sudden there's a shortage of doctors because price controls lead to shortages. You probably remember, some of you, what happened in the 70s when we tried to put controls on gas prices. All of a sudden the lines got longer. Well, it's going to happen when gas stations are replaced by clinics and hospitals. The lines will be long. They'll just be at a health care center, that's all. Or how much money do you suppose it costs a drug company to develop, test, and then get approved for use a new drug, and then distribute it and advertise it? It costs millions and sometimes billions. And if you say to the drug company, you can't charge the prices you're charging, what you're saying to the drug company is, we want you to stop making new medicines, because you're not going to have the money left to do that kind of expensive, extensive research. Well, I would say to the government, why don't you stay out, and then you won't have a doctor shortage or a drug shortage. You'll still have the best healthcare system in the world. Look, I'll admit, in what I now think of as a fit of insanity on my part, a few years ago I decided I would try to find out what makes government bureaucrats do the stupid things they do. What happens to your brain when you go to work for government? So I thought, I'll get it from the horse's mouth. I decided to take a Master of Public Administration degree from Northern Michigan University. Just to see where does this stuff come from? The people that teach the bureaucrats are teaching what? So the first course I was the only person in the entire MPA program that didn't work for the state of Michigan. I'm a theologian. So there's going to be a clash of worldviews here, right? You know? It happened on the first day of the first class. It was a course on public health administration. And the professor was talking about how the healthcare system in Cuba was so much better than the healthcare system in the U.S. Better doctors, better nurses, free drugs, better healthcare, longer life expectancy. And I'm an incurable smart aleck. So I raised my hand. Said, Dr. Syed, it seems like a mystery to me. If things are so good in Cuba and so bad in the United States, why in the world do all those Cubans try to cross the ocean in leaky boats in order to come to America just to die sooner? He says, what are you getting at? Like it wasn't plain to him. It probably wasn't. So I explained to him why American healthcare was better than Cuban. He said, where do you get your information? I said, the government accounting office. He said, you can't trust the government accounting office. It's political. I said, where'd you get yours? He said, the United Nations. You see why I complain about the intellectuals? It's a hopeless, hopeless thing. A few weeks later, let's say 2 or 3 weeks later, he said, look, Mike, don't you understand that human beings are the epiphenomenon of society? Now, it sounds... I'm going to tell you that story tomorrow. Epiphenomenon sounds good, doesn't it? But it's not. I'll tell you tomorrow during the meaning of meaning what he's getting at. And it's appalling because an epiphenomenon is a secondary or derivative existence. If you have a sun and you have a tree, you have a shadow. The combination of sun and tree produce the shadow. The sun and the tree are the primary existences, and the shadow is the epiphenomenon. It owes its existence to those other two things. And he just said that human beings are the epiphenomenon of society. And I said, no way. You got that backwards. It's not that human beings are created when society gets together. It's when human beings get together, society's created. When you, by the way, that's why you have to practice your logic. They will pull this silly stuff on you every day. So I said to him, if it was the way you said, when your view of society gets threatened, someone has to die, right? He said, yeah, sometimes people have to die. Now, everybody else in the room is nodding their heads, yes, sometimes people have to die. So I said to them, it was insulting, I said, you guys all you're all veterinarians, right? And they said, no, we work with people. I said, well, you think like veterinarians. When you take your dog to the vet, you know, the vet looks over the dog and says, Spot's got this problem and that problem. It's going to cost you $400 to fix it. What do you want to do? He asks you and not Spot because you're paying the bills. Now, these guys were all in charge of state health care costs in Michigan. They all have their budgets and they all have bosses they're trying to please and all that. I said, now you guys, we both know that when you get old, in the last 2 years of your life, generally speaking, about three quarters of all your life's medical expenses come up. It's expensive to be old and sick. And I said, you guys know that when old Joe gets old and sick, he gets expensive. And if he's just an epiphenomenon of society, then you'll decide, well, it's time for Joe to cash in the chips. You know, he's got from us what he needs to get. He owes us. He's an epiphenomenon. His existence depends on us. And old Joe goes away. And I'm saying they will kill you if they get the chance, because that's how they think. Don't let them fit you into categories, into groups, into classes. Don't let them think they can manipulate you, that they understand you. They don't. Why must you resist this? Because if you don't, somebody's going to die. Count on it. The life you save might be your own or somebody else's, but the fight has to be engaged, and the sooner the better, and the wider the better. So enlist.